Mike Kaminsky, welcome to The Signal. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Aaron.
Talk about what kind of a person you were when you joined the police. I mean, who were you? What was going on in your life and what compelled you to join?
I had just finished up working with the Bureau of Customs in Washington as a graphic artist, actually. When I came out of the Air Force in 69, I went to work for Westinghouse for a period of time. And then the Bureau of Customs actually signed me up to be the graphic artist at their headquarters in 2100 K Street. So my background as a person had nothing to do with being a police officer. I was a quiet guy. I was married. I had two children, two little daughters. Not a risk taker at all.
So what was the moment of realization for you? I mean, what sparked the interest?
I needed a job. And one of my neighbors was a captain in Baltimore City Police, and he suggested that I apply to the police department because I did need a job. I needed more money, and so I did. It wasn't like I wanted to serve and protect. I just needed a job.
What year was this? How old were you?
I was 26. The year was 1973.
Okay.
And my first assignment was Western District.
Baltimore's Western District is in the neighborhood now famous or infamous, we could say, for the being ground zero of the rioting, the uprising in Baltimore. Paint a picture for us what it was like to be a police officer in that neighborhood in 1973, 1974.
When I was graduating from the police academy, the one place you did not want to go was Western. Western had a reputation of being the Wild West.
When you say that, do you mean because of crime or because of the way the police operated there?
The way the police operated there, actually. Western was, we called it the Wild West. And at that time, if you did anything wrong in the police department, if you came up on charges in anything, they transferred you to Western for disciplinary action.
The Western District was like the penalty box for cops who had messed up on the job.
Right. And that was my first assignment out of the academy. Nobody wanted to go to Western. I didn't want to go to Western. But it became a great place for me to be. Western was really, really unique. It was a place where you could sometimes create your own crimes.
How do you mean?
I remember a couple incidents that I personally created. One was I was on foot patrol with a foot patrol unit, and at times we would do car checks. It's kind of tough to stand in the middle of North Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue and stop a car when you're in the middle of the street and you just put your hand up. So if the vehicle doesn't stop for you, then what we would do would take their tag number, call it in, find out who's registered to the vehicle, write them a ticket, and airmail them a ticket. I would rip up their copy and just throw it into the air. So they would not know that they had a violation until they went for tag registration or something like that.
This kind of immoral behavior was par for the course. This was part of the culture of Western District policing.
Right. You could basically do anything you wanted to if you were a police officer, a cop. And I don't know if it's changed that much, you know, from what I was seeing in the news. I was only with Western District for 10 months. Towards the end of my tour, and I say towards the end of my tour because in July of 74, Baltimore City went on strike. Baltimore City Police Department went on strike. But one thing I did right before the strike came, I was bored one afternoon, and I went to the payphone, called the police department, and said there was a man with a gun in the Oxford Bar. I had nothing else to do that day. It was a Saturday, so I got the call, went in, put everybody against the wall. Of course, nobody had a gun, but I knew they were playing dice in the back room. So I went in the back room, took all their money, and my agreement with them was I wouldn't charge them with anything, but I kept the money. So,
as you look back on this now, I mean, does it seem outrageous to you?
It does seem outrageous. It's illegal. It's wrong. You know, it's morally and ethically wrong.
That being said, though, it did not seem outrageous to any of your fellow officers or supervisors, anyone in the culture of this Western District Department in the 1970s.
Not the people that I worked with, no.
Tell me about how you got involved following this in undercover police work. This was 1976 to 78.
Right. After the police strike, I knew that my career was over with the Baltimore City Police Department because of the activities I was involved with during a strike. And so I resigned from Baltimore City and was picked up, actually, with Anne Arundel County Police. My introduction into undercover narcotics was with my partner, PJ, Paul Joseph Warner. Really a very interesting person. You know, he trusted no one. He didn't trust the police. He didn't trust anybody. There was very few people that he really confided in. For some reason, he liked me. And we became partners. And he was the image of a narcotics cop. He looked like Serpico back in the days when Serpico was big. Actually, that's one of the reasons I wanted to go into undercover narcotics, because of the image. The one thing about narcotics is you're on a gray area about being a cop. You're not, you can do things that are gray, not black and white, but you can bend the rules. And I was really good at bending the rules. And to be a narcotics cop, I saw that you could create your own crimes. You could set up drug deals. And PJ was really, really good at it. So he taught me how to relate to people that I had a hard time relating to in the past.
Talk to me about some of your major arrests that you made as an undercover narcotics officer.
My first one was with a black drug ring in Pioneer City. And my job was quality control for the cocaine shipments. And I tested the shipments coming through. That investigation lasted about 4 months. It really was traumatic when it was over because all my investigations were long-term. But the one with Willie was 4 months. I knew his family by the time it was done, and I knew his children. I played with his children. I liked his wife. And that was a tough part about every investigation that I did, because I lived with you. I knew you. I knew why you were doing what you were doing. It wasn't like you're doing something illegal. I could relate to what you were doing. You create friendships. And when it was done, when it was time to arrest Willie, it was sort of traumatic for me because I was locking up my friend. But they were all like that. I spent 4 or 5 months with the Coast Guard at the Coast Guard Yard in Curtis Bay with Coast Guard Intelligence. My contacts were either with Naval Intelligence, Coast Guard Intelligence, the FBI, or the DEA. When I was with the Pagans for a while, that was with the FBI.
You're talking about a motorcycle gang.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A very violent one.
Yeah, they're...
As it turned out, as you discovered.
They're nasty, yes. They actually beat me up after 10 months. They thought I was an informant. They didn't trust anybody. Actually, when I was with them... they knew there was a cop in the group. I didn't know it at the time, but there was a state trooper undercover with the bikers. And for some reason, after a while, he disappeared, which eased up a little bit for me, but they finally got to me.
So let me pause you there and have you zoom in on some of these moments with some of these organizations and operations. I mean, take us inside the walls of a place like, you know, the Pagan Motorcycle Clubhouse, and just the scenes and sort of moral universe that you get acclimated to when you become like a partner with them and they don't know you're an undercover cop.
I met the president of the Savage Maryland Club with a guy by the name of Tiny, and Tiny was not Tiny. Tiny was a big guy, and I met Tiny just playing pool in a bar called Fly Like an Eagle in Baltimore. And I was introduced to Tiny from one of my friends who worked there, one of the girls that I knew. And that's how I met Tiny. You just don't walk up to somebody and say, yeah, I'd like to talk to you about buying drugs. It takes a while to be trusted, actually. And that was the big part about everything that we did, the trust factor. There was an awful lot of paranoia on both sides. You know, I was always paranoid. And so eventually Tiny and I got together in a conversation, and I asked him about doing some business. And he said, well, come on down to the clubhouse in Savage. And so I took my Triumph. I had a 750 Triumph motorcycle at the time, and I took my Triumph down to the clubhouse. He gave me directions on how to find a clubhouse in Savage. It was an old farmhouse, very secluded out in Savage, Maryland. You had nothing to fall back on if something was going wrong, and they knew that if you weren't alone. And so I knocked on the door. The door opened up, and I introduced myself. I said, "Yeah, Tiny asked me to come down." And so I went in, and I think what they set up was for me to see what could happen. They brought out a guy who had ripped them off on some drugs, and they actually broke his legs and took his motorcycle.
This was your first introduction
yeah.
to the clubhouse and your first official audience with this guy, Tiny,
right.
when it came time to do business.
Right.
You ended up doing deals with him, making buys from him, and mm-hmm. you ended up putting him away.
Right, yeah.
Talk about what that day was like.
Well, I didn't plan this, but eventually they thought I was an informant, and they set me up with a buy. It was a Saturday night. I really didn't feel like working that night, but they called me. Tiny called me up, and he said he's got, I forget how much, marijuana that he wants to front me and give to me. I said, "I don't have any money. I don't really feel like doing it, Tiny." He said, We'll trust you on this. You know, meet us at the parking lot of the Sierra Club. That's in Anne Arundel County. I haven't been down there for a long time, but I don't even know if it's there. But they said, meet us at the parking lot of the Sierra Club, and we'll front you some drugs. And so, not that I wanted to. I didn't feel really good about this. Sometimes you can feel it, that it's not going to go well. You know, there's just something in your mind. And so I said, okay. And I went down there, and they basically surrounded me on the parking lot of the Sierra Club, and because they thought I was an informant. They wanted to kill me. They started beating me up, and what saved me was people coming out of the nightclub, and they saw what was going on, and the guys that were beating me up, were afraid that they were going to get locked up. The police were going to come. So they left me laying there. And eventually I called my sergeant, told him what had happened, and he said, "Get down here, type up the warrants." And what they did was type up 13 arrest warrants, and they went into the clubhouse really early in the morning around 5 o'clock and put ropes around each one of the necks of the guys that beat me up and pulled them out with the ropes. And that's how that one ended.
You're listening to The Signal on WYPR. I'm Aaron Henkin here in studio with former Baltimore police officer, Anne Arundel police officer as well, Michael B. Kaminsky. His book, Life After Russian Roulette, Game Over, is based on his real-life experiences as, among other things, an undercover narcotics officer in the 1970s. Tell me more about this part of your job that's built around manipulating people's trust and emotions and then turning that trust against them to bring them down. I mean, what kind of an effect does this work end up having on you, on your soul?
Psychologically and spiritually, it's very destructive, very painful. You do wrong things for the right reasons, and that affects your morals and your mind. And if you're a straight cop, you're not going to live. You're not going to be successful in something like this.
It seems like you really have to be ready, willing, and able to shrug off major sacrifices in life, too, like your relationship with your wife and kids.
Mm-hmm. In order to get to where you want to be, you really have to overlook an awful lot of stuff. And
you lost your family. I mean, they were estranged to you.
Yeah, I was married to my first wife. I was married to my first wife. I think we were married in 1970, before I became a cop. And I had two daughters when I joined the police department. And it was a good time. We were okay. We were a good family during the time I was a uniform police officer. But when you get transferred into organized crime and drug groups, in order to be good at what you're doing, you have to marry the job and let go of the family. You know, when I was doing it, when PJ and I were together, we had an apartment in Glen Burnie that the government gave to us, and we had an expense account. We lived like a bohemian life.
You were, frankly, major alcoholics.
Yeah, I was an alcoholic probably from the 12th grade, but I became really addicted to alcohol as a cop, as a police officer.
And you're also working with drug dealers, I imagine. And I mean, you mentioned you were the quality control guy for a cocaine distributor.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You're getting high on drugs, too.
No, I actually never really tried hardcore drugs. The only drugs that I ever really tried was marijuana, and then marijuana laced with PCP, phencyclidine. I never tried cocaine. I never tried heroin. And my reason for not trying it was I tried to tell people that this is my business and I wasn't going to use up my profits.
I wonder if I might back you up to this sort of apartment headquarters mm-hmm. you were talking about, Mike, with you and your undercover colleague, PJ. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you might read a passage from your book. This is from a moment well into your undercover career. You were working with this officer, PJ, and this passage on page 184 is a really interesting glimpse into your undercover headquarters and also, I think, what the work was doing to your mind,
okay.
to your spirit.
I walked aimlessly around the dirty apartment in which the government authorized PJ and I to set up operations a long time ago. Shadows moved with me. Shadows of the people who became friends, then whose lives I destroyed. PJ and I furnished the sparse apartment with old and used things that people were throwing away. We never cleaned the apartment either. The stale smell of empty wine bottles and beer cans emanated from the corners. This decor was an intentional design, but it was also a reflection of our lives. As I walked around the bare apartment drinking brandy from a dirty glass, my mind raced with ways to escape. Just show me the way, I continued to pray. Just tell me how to end this life that I created.
Michael B. Kaminsky reading from his book, Life After Russian Roulette, Game Over. Kaminsky worked as an undercover narcotics officer in and around Baltimore in the mid-1970s. And Michael, is it fair to say that you were essentially a suicidal person at this point in your career?
Yes. At that point in my career, I was very suicidal. I wasn't suicidal before I became a cop, and not really when I was in uniform. But what drove me to those feelings were the investigations. And again, when you do long-term investigations, they're not just names that you know of. They're human beings. They're people that you have grown to like and grown to, at sometimes, respect. And so every time that I would end finish an investigation, I was mentally ill, and they began to haunt me. The people that I had destroyed began to haunt me, and I hated my life.
You have to wonder how you can do a job like that without this continuous erosion of idealism, right? Over the course of your whatever idealism you started with,
mm-hmm.
even if it wasn't that much to begin with, it's gone at this point in your career. Is there any way for a person to do this job without this consequence happening?
There is, and I think it's why you become a police officer in the first place. You know, what are your reasons for becoming a police officer? If you're very idealistic about it, if your goal has been that you always wanted to be a police officer and you wanted to help people and save lives and stuff like that, you shouldn't be doing undercover work because it will destroy you. I wasn't idealistic when I joined the police department. I needed a job. And when I joined the police department back in the 70s, you know, unless you had a felony charge against you, if your record was clean and you had experience in the military from Vietnam, chances are they were going to hire you as a police officer. And I had both, you know. And if I saw being a police officer as a way to carry a gun again. I didn't join the police department to protect and to serve. You know, I joined it to satisfy my personal goals. And
I have to say it's so just like fundamentally alarming for me to hear that from someone who was spent a career as a police officer. And I think what's so alarming is to hear someone speak so frankly as a human being about those motivations. I mean, there's this, everyone refers to it as the blue wall of silence that police officers band together behind. And this is a wall of silence that you have very consciously made a decision to break.
Yes.
I wonder if you were invited to I don't think you will be invited. But if you were invited to speak to the graduating class like this year at Baltimore City's mm-hmm. Police Academy, mm-hmm. what would you say to a room full of new recruits? What words of wisdom would you have for these new young people who are about to embark on, you know, this career that you've got your own experience with?
I would have to ask the graduating class just to take a moment individually and go inside of yourself and reflect on one of the reasons you want to wear a badge. For me, the badge was a sense of power. You know, that badge for me was the authority to do anything I wanted to do. That was the wrong reason for wanting to be a police officer, just to wear that badge and to carry a gun. Maybe each person sitting in that graduating class needs to write down their credo, their creed about why they want to be a police officer.
Michael B. Kaminsky is a former Baltimore City police officer and a former undercover narcotics officer. His book is titled Life After Russian Roulette, Game Over. You can find out more about him online at michaelbkaminsky.com. And Michael, thank you very much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Aaron. Thank you.
You're tuned to The Signal, an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore.